Ruby, Oklahoma, way out in the middle of nowhere. You been there?
Not yet, but I plan to check it out. Say they got the best rhubarb pie in the nation.
I hate rhubarb.
Hate it? Girl, you ain't lived. You ain't lived at all.
I'm going home, see my folks.
Where's home for you?
Frisco.
All my folks live in Frisco. I just talked to my grandfather. They're waiting on me.
Dice nodded, but said nothing.
Gigi stuffed the brownie wrapper in her empty paper cup. I am not lost, she thought. Not lost at all. I can go see Granddaddy, or go back to the bay, or... The train slowed. Dice rose to collect his luggage from the overhead rack. He was so short, he had to stand on tiptoe. Gigi helped him, and he didn't seem to mind.
Well, I get off here. Nice talking with you.
You too.
Good luck.
Watch out now. Don't get wet. If the boys standing in front of a kind of barbecue grill had said, "No, this is Alcorn, Mississippi," she probably would have believed them. Same haircuts, same stares, same loose, hick smiles. What her granddaddy called country's country. Some girls were there too, arguing, it seemed, with one of them. In any case, they weren't much help, but she enjoyed the waves of raw horniness slapping her back as she walked off down the street. First dust, fine as flour, sifted into her eyes, her mouth. Then the wind wrecked her hair. Suddenly she was out of town. What the locals called Central Avenue just stopped, and Gigi was at Ruby's Edge at the same time she had reached its center. The wind, soundless, came from the ground rather than the sky. One minute, her heels clicked. The next, they were mute in swirling dirt. On either side of her, tall grass rolled like water. She had stopped 5 minutes ago in a so-called drugstore, bought cigarettes, and learned that the boys at the barbecue grill were telling the truth. There was no motel, and if there was any pie, it wasn't served at a restaurant, because there wasn't one of those either. Other than the picnic benches at the barbecue thing, there was no public place to sit down. All around her were closed doors and shut windows, where parted curtains were swiftly replaced. So much for Ruby, she thought. Mikey must have sent her that lying freak on the train. She just wanted to see, not just the thing in the wheat field, but whether there was anything at all the world had to say for itself. In rock, tree, or water that wasn't body bags or little boys spitting blood into their hands so as not to ruin their shoes. So, Alcorn. She might as well start over in Alcorn, Mississippi. Sooner or later, one of those trucks parked by the seed and feed store would have to start up, and she would hitch the hell out of there. Holding onto her hair and squinting against the wind, Gigi considered walking back toward the feed store. Her backpack felt heavy at high heels, and if she didn't move, the wind might topple her. As suddenly as it had begun, the wind quit. In its absence, she heard an engine coming toward her. "You headed out to the convent?" A man in a wide-brimmed hat opened the door of his van. Gigi tossed her backpack on the seat and climbed in. "Convent? You kidding? Anything but. Can you put me near a real bus stop or train station or something?" "You in luck. take you right to the track. Great. Gigi dug around in the pack between her knees. Smells new. Brand new. You all my first trip. You all? Have to make a stop. Another passenger going to take a train ride, too. He smiled. My name's Roger. Roger Best. Gigi. But you free. The other one I charge, he said, cutting his eyes away from the road, pretending to examine the scenery through the passenger window. He looked at her navel first, then further down, then up. Gigi pulled out a mirror and, as best she could, repaired the wind damage to her hair, thinking, yeah, I'm free all right. And she was. Just as Roger Best said, there was no charge to the living, but the dead cost $25. Every now and then, the woman sitting on the porch steps lifted her aviator's glasses to wipe her eyes. One braid from under her straw hat fell down her back. Roger leaned on his knee and spoke to her for what seemed to Gigi a long time. Then they both went inside. When Roger came out, he was closing his wallet and frowning. Ain't no help out here. You may as well wait inside. Going to take me a while to get the body down. Gigi turned to look behind her, but couldn't see through the partition. Jesus, shit, this here's a hearse? Sometimes it's an ambulance. Today it's a hearse. He was all business now, no quick glances at her breast. Got to get it on board the MKT at 8:20 p.m., and I got to be there not in time, but on time. Gigi was quick but clumsy, stepping out of the van, now hers, but she made it around the house, up the wide wooden stairs, and through the front doors in no time at all. He had said convent, so she thought sweet but stern women, floating in sailboat hats above long black sleeves. But there was nobody, and the woman in the straw hat had disappeared. Gigi walked through a marble foyer into another one, twice the size. In the dimness, she could see a hallway extending to the right and to the left. In front of her, more wide stairs. Before she could decide which way to go, Roger was behind her, carrying a metal something with wheels. He moved toward the stairs, mumbling, "Not a bit of help, not a bit." Gigi turned right, rushing toward light coming from under a pair of swing doors. Inside was the longest table she had ever seen, in the biggest kitchen. She sat there, chewing her thumbnail, wondering just how bad could it be riding with a dead person. There was some herb in her pack. Not much, but enough, she thought, to keep her from freaking. She reached out and pinched off a bit of crust from a pie sitting before her and noticed for the first time the place was loaded with food, mostly untouched. Several cakes, more pies, potato salad, a ham, a large dish of baked beans. There must be nuns, she thought. Or maybe all this was from the funeral. Suddenly, like a legitimate mourner, she was ravenous. Gigi was gobbling, piling more food onto her plate even while she scooped from it. When the woman entered without her straw hat or her glasses and lay down on the stone cold floor. Her mouth was full of baked beans and chocolate cake, so Gigi could not speak. Outside, Roger's horn blasted. Gigi put her spoon down, but held on to the cake as she walked over to where the woman lay. Squatting down, She wiped her mouth and said, "Can I help you?" The woman's eyes were closed, but she shook her head no. "Is it anybody else here I can call?" She opened her eyes then, and Gigi saw nothing, just a faint circle where the edge of the iris used to be. "Hey, girl, you coming?" Roger's voice was puny and distant over the throb of his engine. "I got a train to meet. On time. I got to be on time." Gigi leaned down closer, gazing into eyes with nothing to recommend them. "I said, is anybody else here?" "You," she murmured. "You here." Each word sailed toward Gigi on a wave of alcohol breath. "You hear me? I can't wait all day," Roger warned. Gigi waved her free hand across the woman's face to make sure she was blind as well as drunk. "Stop that," said the woman, whispering but annoyed. "Oh," said Gigi, "I thought, why don't you let me get you a chair?" "I'm gone here. Gone." Gigi heard the engine rev and the hearse shift from neutral into reverse. "I'm missing my ride. What do you want me to do?" The woman turned over on her side and folded her hands under her cheek. "Be a darling. Just watch. I haven't closed my eyes in 17 days. Wouldn't a bed do the trick? Be a darling. Be a darling. I don't want to sleep when nobody there to watch. On the floor?" But she was asleep, breathing like a child. Gigi stood up and looked around the kitchen, slowly swallowing cake. At least there were no dead people here now. The sound of the hearse grew fainter, then slipped away. Fright, not triumph, spoke in every foot of the embezzler's mansion. Shaped like a live cartridge, it curved to a deadly point at the north end, where originally the living and dining rooms lay. He must have believed his persecutors would come from the north, because all the first floor windows huddled into those two rooms, like lookouts. The southern end contained signs of his desire in two rooms, an outsized kitchen and a room where he could play rich men's games. Neither room had a view, but the kitchen had one of the mansion's two entrances. A veranda curved from the north around the bullet's tip, continued along its wall past the main entrance, and ended at the flat end of the ammunition, its southern exposure. Except from the bedrooms, no one in the house could see the sun rise, and there was no vantage point to see it set. The light, therefore, was always misleading. He must have planned to have a lot of good time company in his fortress. 8 bedrooms, 2 giant bathrooms, a cellar of storerooms that occupied as much space as the first floor. And he wanted to amuse his guests so completely they would not think of leaving for days on end. His efforts to entertain were no more sophisticated or interesting than he was. Mostly food, sex, and toys. After 2 years of semi-covert construction, he managed 1 voluptuous party before he was arrested, just as he feared, by northern lawmen, one of whom attended his first and only party. The 4 teaching sisters who moved into his house when it was offered for sale at a pittance diligently canceled the obvious echoes of his delight, but could do nothing to hide his terror. The closed-off, protected back, the poised and watchful tip, an entrance door guarded by the remaining claws of some monstrous statuary, which the sisters had removed at once. A rickety, ill-hanging kitchen door, the only vulnerability. Gigi, as high as possible on her limited supply, and roaming through the mansion while the drunken woman slept on the kitchen floor, immediately recognized the conversion of the dining room into a schoolroom, the living room into a chapel, and the game room alteration into an office, cue sticks and balls, but no pool table. Then she discovered the traces of the sisters' failed industry, the female torso candle holders in the candelabra hanging from the hall ceiling, the curls of hair winding through vines that once touched faces now chipped away, the nursing cherubim emerging from layers of paint in the foyer, the nipple-tipped doorknobs, layabouts half-naked in old-timey clothes, drinking and fondling each other in prints stacked in closets, a Venus or two among several pieces of nude statuary beneath the cellar stairs. She even found the brass male genitalia that had been ripped from sinks and tubs packed away in a chest of sawdust, as if, however repelled by the hardware's demands, the sisters valued, nevertheless, its metal. Gigi toyed with the fixtures, turning the testicles designed to release water from the penis. She sucked the last bit of joint, Ming One, and laid the roach on one of the alabaster vaginas in the game room. She imagined men contentedly knocking their cigars against those ashtrays, or perhaps just resting them there, knowing without looking that the glowing tip was slowly building a delicate head. She avoided the bedrooms because she didn't know which one had belonged to the dead person. But when she went to use one of the bathrooms, she saw that no toilet activity was not meant to be reflected in a mirror that reflected in another. Most, firmly set into wall tile, had been painted. Bending to examine the mermaids holding up the tub, she noticed a handle fastened to a slab of wood surrounded by floor tile. She was able to reach and lift the handle, but not able to budge it. Suddenly she was fiercely hungry again and returned to the kitchen to eat and do as the woman had asked, be a darling and watch while she slept. Like an antique tripper, afraid to come down alone. She was finished with the macaroni, some ham, and another slice of cake when the woman on the floor stirred and sat up. She held her face in both hands for a moment, then rubbed her eyes. Feel better? Asked Gigi. She took a pair of sunglasses from an apron pocket and put them on. No, but rested. Well, that is better. The woman got up. I suppose. Thank you for staying. Sure. Hangover's a bitch. I'm Gigi. Who died? A love, said the woman. I had two. She was the first and the last. Oh, I'm sorry, Gigi said. Where is he taking her? The dude in the hearse. Far, to a lake named for her. Superior. That's how she wanted it. Who else lives here? You didn't cook all this food, did you? The woman filled the saucepan with water and shook her head. What you gonna do now? Gigi, 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 Gigi. That's what frogs say. What did your mother name you? Her? She gave me her own name. Well, Grace. Grace, what could be better?
Nothing. Nothing at all. If ever there came a morning when mercy and simple good fortune took to their heels and fled, grace alone might have to do. But from where it would come and how fast, in that holy hollow between sighting and following through, could grace slip through at all? It was the I Give woman, serving up her breasts like two baked Alaskas on a platter, that took all the kick out of looking in the boy's eyes. Gigi watched him battle his stare and lose every time. He said his name was KD and tried hard to enjoy her face as much as her cleavage while he talked. It was a struggle, she expected, rose to and took pleasure in, normally. But the picture she had wakened to an hour earlier spoiled it. Unwilling to sleep on the second floor where a person had just died, Gigi had chosen the leather sofa in the used-to-be game room office. Windowless, dependent on no longer available electricity for light, the room encouraged her to sleep deeply and long. She missed the morning entirely and woke in the afternoon, in a darkness hardly less than she'd fallen asleep in. Hanging on the wall in front of her was the etching she had barely glanced at when poking around the day before. Now it loomed into her line of vision in the skinny light from the hall. A woman on her knees. A knocked-down look. Cast-up, begging eyes. Arms outstretched, holding up her present on a platter to a lord. Gigi tiptoed over and leaned close to see who was the woman with the I Give Up face. St. Catherine of Siena was engraved on a small plaque in the gilt frame. Gigi laughed. Brass dicks hidden in a box, pudding tits exposed on a plate. But in fact, it didn't feel funny. So when the boy she had seen in town the day before parked his car near the kitchen door and blew his horn, her interest in him had an edge of annoyance. Propped in the doorway, she ate jam-covered bread while she listened to him and watched the war waged in his eyes. His smile was lovely, and his voice attractive. "Been riding around looking all over for you. Heard you was out here. Thought you might be still." "Who told you that?" "A friend." "Well, a friend of a friend." "You mean that Hearst dude?" "Uh-huh. Says you changed your mind about getting to the train station." "News sure travels fast out here, even if nothing else does." "We get around. Wanna go for a ride? Go as fast as you want." Gigi licked jam from her thumb and forefinger. She looked to the left toward the garden and thought she saw in the distance a glint of metal or maybe a mirror reflecting light as from a state trooper's sunglasses. "Give me a minute," she said. "Change my clothes." In the game room, she put on a yellow skirt and a dark red top. Then she consulted her astrology chart before stuffing her belongings and a few souvenirs in her backpack, which she slung into the car's rear seat. "Hey," said KD, "we're just going for a little ride." "Yeah," she answered, "but who knows? I might change my mind again." They drove through mile after mile of sky blue sky. Gigi had not really looked at the scenery from the train windows or the bus. As far as she was concerned, there was nothing out there. But speeding along in the Impala was more like
cruising on a DC-10, and the nothing turned out to be sky. Unignorable, custom-made, designer sky. Not empty either, but full of breath, and all the eye was meant for. That's the shortest skirt I ever saw. He smiled his lovely smile. Minis, said Gigi. In the real world, they're called miniskirts. Don't they make people stare at you? Stare, drive for miles, have car wrecks, talk stupid. You must like it. Reckon that's what they're for, though. You explain your clothes, I'll explain mine. Where'd you get those pants, for instance? What's wrong with them? Nothing. Listen, you want to argue, take me back. No, I don't want to argue. I just want to ride. Yeah? How fast? Told you, fast as I can. How long? Long as you want. How far? All the way. The desert couple was big, Mikey said. From any angle you looked, he said. They took up the sky, moving, moving. Liar, thought Gigi. Not this sky. This here sky was bigger than everything, including a woman with her breasts on a tray. When Mavis pulled into the driveway near the kitchen door, she slammed the brakes so hard her packages slid from the seat and fell beneath the dashboard. The figure sitting in the garden's red chair was totally naked. She could not see the face under the hat's brim, but she knew it wore no sunglasses. A mere month she'd been away, and for 3 weeks of that time, couldn't wait to get back. Something must have happened, she thought, to Mother, to Connie. At the squeal of the brakes, the sunning figure did not move. Only when she slammed the Cadillac door did the person sit up and push back the hat, calling out, Connie? Connie? Mavis hurried toward the garden's edge. Who the hell are you? Where's Connie? The naked girl yawned and scratched her pubic hair. Mavis? She asked. Relieved to learn she was known, spoken of at least, Mavis lowered her voice. What are you doing out here like that? Where's Connie? Like what? She's inside. You're naked. Yeah, so? You want the cigar? Do they know? Mavis glanced toward the house. Lady, said Gigi, are you looking at something you never saw before? Or something you don't have? Or you a clothes freak or what? There you are. Connie came down the steps, her arms wide toward Mavis. I missed you. They hugged, and Mavis surrendered to the thump of the woman's heart against her own. Who is she, Connie? And where are her clothes? Oh, that's little Grace. She came the day after Mother died. Died? When? 7 days now. 7. But I brought the things. I have it all in the car. No use. Not for her, anyway. My heart's all scrunched. But now you back, I feel like cooking. You haven't been eating? Mavis shot a cold glance at Gigi. A bit. Funeral foods. But now I'll cook fresh. There's plenty, said Gigi. We haven't even touched a... You put some clothes on. You kiss my ass. Do it, Grace, said Connie. Go. Like a good girl. Cover yourself. We love you just the same. She ever hear of sunbathing? Go on now. Gigi went, exaggerating the switch of both the cheeks she had offered Mavis. What rock did she crawl out from under? Mavis asked. Hush, said Connie. Soon you'll like her. No way, Mavis thought. No way at all.
Mother's gone, but Connie's okay.
I've been here almost 3 years, and this house is where we are. Us, not her. They did everything but slap each other. And finally, they did that. What postponed the inevitable were loves forlorn and a very young girl in too tight clothes tapping on the screen door.
You have to help me, she said. You have to. I've been raped, and it's almost August.
Only part of that was true.
Seneca.
Something was scratching on the pane, again. Dovey turned over on her stomach, refusing to look out of the window each time she heard it. He wasn't there. He never came at night. Deliberately, she drove her mind on to everyday things. What would she fix for supper tomorrow? Not much point to garden peas. May as well used canned. Not a taste bud in Stewart's mouth could tell the difference. Blue Boy, packed in his cheek for 20 years, first narrowed his taste to a craving for spices, then reduced it altogether to a single demand for hot pepper. When they got married, Dovey was sure she could never cook well enough to suit the twin known to be pickier than his brother, Deke. Back from the war, both men were hungry for down-home food, but dreaming of it for 3 years had raised their expectations, exaggerated the possibilities of lard making biscuits lighter than snow. The responsibility sharp cheese took on in Hominy. When they were discharged and back home, Deke hummed with pleasure as he sucked sweet marrow from hocks or crunched chicken bones to powder. But Stewart remembered everything differently. Shouldn't the clove be down in the tissue, not just sitting on top of the ham? And the chicken fried steak? Vidalia onions or Spanish? On her wedding day, Dovey had stood facing the flowered wallpaper, her back to the window, so her sister, Soane, could see better. Dovey held up the hem of her slip while Soane drew the seams. The little brush tickled the backs of her legs, but she stood perfectly still. There were no silk stockings in Haven or the world in 1949, but to get married, obviously barelegged, mocked God and the ceremony. I don't expect he'll be satisfied at table, Dovey told her sister. Why not? I don't know. He compliments my cooking, then suggests how to improve it next time. Hold still, Dovey. Deke doesn't do that to you, does he? Not that. He's picky other ways. But I wouldn't worry about it if I was you. If he's satisfied in bed, the table won't mean a thing. They laughed then, and Soane had to do a whole seam over. Now, the difficulty that loomed in 1949 had been solved by tobacco. It didn't matter whether her peas were garden fresh or canned. Convent peppers, hot as hellfire, did all the cooking for her. The trouble it took to cultivate peas was wasted. A teaspoon of sugar and a plop of butter in canned ones would do nicely, since the bits of purple-black pepper he would sprinkle over them bombed away any quiet flavor. Take late squash, for example. Almost always these nights, when Dovey Morgan thought about her husband, it was in terms of what he had lost. His sense of taste, one example of the many she counted. Contrary to his and all of Ruby's assessment, the more Stewart acquired, the more visible his losses. The sale of his herd at 1958's top dollar accompanied his defeat in the statewide election for church secretary because of his outspoken contempt for the school children sitting in that drugstore in Oklahoma City. He had even written a hateful letter to the woman who organized the students. His position had not surprised her, since 10 years earlier he'd called Thurgood Marshall a stir-up Negro for handling the NAACP's segregation suit in Norman. In 1962, the natural gas drilled to 10,000 feet on the ranch filled his pockets, but shrunk their land to a toy ranch, and he lost the trees that had made it so beautiful to behold. His hairline and his taste buds faltered over time, small losses that culminated with the big one. In 1964, when he was 40, Ferry's curse came true. They learned neither could ever have children. Now, almost 10 years later, he had cleaned up, as he put it, in a real estate deal in Muskogee, and Dovey didn't have to wonder what else he would lose now, because he was already in a losing battle with Reverend Meisner over words attached to the lip of the oven, an argument fueled in part, Dovey thought, by what nobody talked about, young people in trouble or acting up behind every door. Arnett, home from college, wouldn't leave her bed. Harper, jury's boy, menace, drunk every weekend since he got back from Vietnam. Roger's granddaughter, Billy Delia, had disappeared into thin air. Jeff's wife, Sweetie, laughing at jokes no one made. KD's mess with that girl living out at the convent, not to speak of the sass, the pout, the outright defiance of some of the others, the ones who wanted to name the oven such and such place, and who had decided that the original words on it were something that enraged Stuart and Deke. Dovey had talked to her sister and sister-in-law about it, to Mabel Fleetwood, to Anna Flood, to a couple of women in the club. Opinions were varied, confusing, even incoherent, because feelings ran so high over the matter. Also because some young people, by snickering at Miss Esther's finger memory, had insulted entire generations preceding them. They had not suggested politely that Miss Esther may have been mistaken. They howled at the notion of remembering invisible words you couldn't even read by tracing letters you couldn't pronounce. "Did she see them?" asked the sons. "Better than that," shouted the fathers. "She felt them, touched them, put her finger on them. If she was blind, sir, we could believe her. That'd be like Braille. But some 5-year-old kid who couldn't read her own tombstone if she climbed out of her grave and stood in front of it?" The twins frowned. Fleet, thinking of his mother-in-law's famous generosity, leapt out of the pew and had to be held back. The Methodists, early on, had smiled at the dissension among the Baptists. The Pentecostals laughed out loud, but not for long. Young members in their own churches began to voice opinions about the words. Each congregation had people who were among or related to the 15 families to leave Haven and start over. The oven didn't belong to any one denomination. It belonged to all, and all were asked to show up at Calvary to discuss it, Reverend Meisner said. The weather was cool, the garden scents strong, and when they assembled at 7:30, the atmosphere was pleasant, people simply curious. And it remained so right through Meisner's opening remarks. Maybe the young folks were nervous, but when they spoke, starting with Luther Beauchamp's sons, Royal and Destry.
Their voices were so strident, the women, embarrassed, looked down at their pocketbooks, shocked.
The men forgot to blink. It would have been better for everyone if the young people had spoken softly, acknowledged their upbringing as they presented their views. But they didn't want to discuss. They wanted to instruct. No ex-slave would tell us to be scared all the time, to beware God, to always be ducking and diving, trying to look out every minute in case he's getting ready to throw something at us, keep us down.
You say, sir, when you speak to men, said Sergeant Person.
Sorry, sir, but what kind of message is that? No ex-slave who had the guts to make his own way, build a town out of nothing, could think like that. No ex-slave, Deacon Morgan cut him off.
That's my grandfather you talking about.
Quit calling him an ex-slave like that's all he was. He was also an ex-lieutenant governor, an ex-banker, an ex-deacon, and a whole lot of other exes, and he wasn't making his own way. He was part of a whole group making their own way.
Having caught Reverend Meisner's eyes, the boy was firm.
He was born in slavery times, sir. He was a slave, wasn't he? Everybody born in slavery time wasn't a slave. Not the way you mean it.
There's just one way to mean it, sir, said Destry.
You don't know what you're talking about. None of them do. Don't know jack shit, shouted Harper Jury.
Whoa, whoa, Reverend Meisner interrupted. Brothers, sisters, we call this meeting in God's own house to try and find one of his houses, snarled Sergeant.
All right, one of his houses, but whichever one, he demands respect from those who are in it. Am I right or am I right?
Harper sat down.
I apologize for the language.
To him, he said, pointing upward.
That might please him, said Meisner.
Might not.
Don't limit your respect to him, Brother Jury. He cautions every which way against it.
Reverend,
the Reverend Pulliam stood up. He was a dark, wiry man, white-haired and impressive. We have a problem here. You, me, everybody. The problem is with the way some of us talk. The grown-ups, of course, should use proper language. But the young people, what they say is more like back talk than talk. What we're here for is...
Royal Beauchamp actually interrupted him.
The Reverend. What is talk if it's not back? You all just don't want us to talk at all. Any talk is back talk if you don't agree with what's being said, sir.
Everybody was so stunned by the boy's brazenness, they hardly heard what he said.
Pulliam, dismissing the possibility that Roy's parents, Luther and Helen Beauchamp, were there, turned slowly to Meisner.
Reverend, can't you keep that boy still?
Why would I want to? Asked Meisner.
We're here not just to talk, but to listen too.
The gasps were more felt than heard. Pulliam narrowed his eyes and was about to answer when Deke Morgan left the row and stood in the aisle.
Well, sir, I have listened, and I believe I have heard as much as I need to.
Now you all listen to me real close. Nobody, I mean nobody, is going to change the oven or call it something strange. Nobody is going to mess with the thing our grandfathers built. They made each and every brick one at a time with their own hands.
Deke looked steadily at Roy.
They dug the clay, not you. They carried the hod, not you.
He turned his head to include Destry, Hurston, and Kayleen Poole, Lorcas,
and Linda Sands. They mixed the mortar, not a one of you. They made good, strong brick for that oven when their own shelters were sticks and sod. You understand what I'm telling you? And we respected what they had gone through to do it. Nothing was handled more gently than the bricks, those men. Men, hear me? Not slaves, ex or otherwise. The bricks those men made. Tell them, Sergeant, how delicate was the separation, how careful we were, how we wrapped them, each and every one. Tell them, Fleet, you, see right, you, Harper, you tell him if I'm lying. Me and my brother lifted that iron, the two of us. And if some letters fell off, it wasn't due to us because we packed it in straw like it was a mewing lamb. So understand me when I tell you, nobody is going to come along some 80 years later claiming to know better what men who went through hell to learn knew. Act short with me all you want. You in long trouble if you think you can disrespect a row you never hold. 20 varieties of amen italicized Deke's pronouncement. The point he'd made would have closed off further argument if Meisner had not said, "Seems to me, Deke, they are respecting it. It's because they do know the oven's value that they want to give it new life." The mutter unleashed by this second shift to the young people's position rose to a roar, which subsided only to hear how the antagonists responded. They don't want to give it nothing. They want to kill it, change it into something they made up. "It's our history too, sir, not just yours," said Roy. "Then act like it. I just told you, that oven already has a history. It doesn't need you to fix it." "Wait now, Deke," said Richard Meisner. "Think what's been said. Forget naming the oven. What's at issue is clarifying the motto." "Motto? Motto? We talking command." Reverend Pulliam pointed an elegant finger at the ceiling. "Beware the furrow of his brow. That's what it says, clear as daylight. That's not a suggestion. That's an order." "Well, no. It's not clear as daylight," said Meisner. "It says, the furrow of his brow. There's no beware on it." "You weren't there. Esther was. And you weren't here either at the beginning. Esther was." Arnold Fleetwood's right hand shook with warning. "She was a baby. She could have been mistaken," said Meisner. "Now Fleet, join Deke in the aisle. Esther never made a mistake of that nature in her life. She knew all there was to know about Haven and Ruby, too. She visited us before we had a road. She named this town, damn it. Excuse me, ladies." Destry, looking strained and close to tears, held up his hand and asked, "Excuse me, sir, what's so wrong about Be the Furrow? Be the furrow of his brow." "You can't be God, boy." Nathan Dupre spoke kindly as he shook his head. "It's not being him, sir. It's being his instrument, his justice as a race. God's justice is his alone. How you going to be his instrument if you don't do what he says?" asked Reverend Pulliam. "You have to obey him." "Yes, sir, but we are obeying him," said Destry. "If we follow his commandments, we'll be his voice, his retribution as a people." Harper jury silenced him. "It says beware, not be. Beware means look out. The power is mine. Get used to it. Be means you putting him aside, and you the power," said Sergeant. "We are the power if we just, see what I mean? See what I mean? Listen to that. You hear that, Reverend? That boy needs a strap. blasphemy.
As could have been predicted, Stuart had the last word, or at least the words they all remembered as last, because they broke the meeting up. "Listen here," he said, his voice thick and shapely with Blue Boy. "If you, any one of you, ignore, change, take away, or add to the words in the mouth of that oven, I will blow your head off, just like you was a hood-eye snake." Dovey Morgan, chilled by her husband's threat, could only look at the floorboards and wonder what visible shape his loss would take now. Days later, she still hadn't made up her mind about who or which side was right, and in discussion with others, including Stuart, she tended to agree with whomever she was listening to. This matter was one she would bring to her friend when he came back to her. Driving away from the meeting at Calvary, Stuart and Dovey had a small but familiar disagreement about where to go. He was headed out to the ranch. It was reduced to a show ranch now that gas rights had been sold, but in Stuart's mind, it was home, where his American flag flew on holidays, where his honorable discharge papers were framed, where Ben and Good could be counted on to bang their tails maniacally when he appeared. But the little house they kept on St. Matthew Street, a foreclosure the twins never resold, was becoming more and more home to Dovey. It was close to her sister, to Mount Calvary, the women's club. It was also where her friend chose to pay his calls. "Drop me right here, Stuart. I'll walk the rest of the way." "You're gonna catch your death." "No, I won't. Night chill feels good right now." "Girl, you a torment," he said, but he patted her thigh before she got out. Dovey walked slowly down Central Avenue. In the distance, she could see lanterns from the Juneteenth picnic hanging near the oven. 4 months now, and no one had taken them down to store for next year. Now they provided light, just a little, just enough, for other kinds of freedom celebrations going on in its shadows. On her left was the bank, not as tall as any of the churches, but seeming nevertheless to hog the street. Neither brother had wanted a second floor like the Haven Bank had, where the lodge kept its quarters. They didn't want traffic into their building for any reason other than bank business. The Haven Bank their father owned collapsed for a whole lot of reasons, and one of them, Stuart maintained, was having lodge meetings on the premises. "Ravels the concentration," he'd said. 3 streets beyond, on her right, next to Patricia Best's house, was the school where Dovey had taught while the ranch house was being completed, but Soan had taught longer since she lived so close. Pat ran the school by herself now, with Reverend Meisner and Anna Flood filling in for Negro history classes and after-school typing lessons. The flowers and vegetables on one side of the school were an extension of the garden in front of Pat's own house. Dovey turned left into St. Matthew Street. The moon's light glittered white fences gone slant in an effort to hold back chrysanthemums, foxglove, sunflowers, cosmos, daylilies, while mint and silver king pressed through the spaces at the bottom of the slats. The night sky, like a handsome lid, held the perfume down, saving it
intensifying it, refusing it the slightest breeze on which to escape. The garden battles, won, lost, still at bay, were mostly over. They had raged for 10 years, having begun suddenly in 1963 when there was time. The women who were in their 20s when Ruby was founded in 1950 watched for 13 years an increase in bounty that had never entered their dreams. They bought soft toilet paper, used washcloths instead of rags, soap for the face alone or diapers only. In every Ruby household, appliances pumped, hummed, sucked, purred, whispered, and flowed. And there was time. 15 minutes when no firewood needed tending in a kitchen stove. 1 whole hour when no sheets or overalls needed slapping or scrubbing on a washboard. 10 minutes gained because no rug needed to be beaten, no curtains pinned on a stretcher. 2 hours because food lasted and therefore could be picked or purchased in greater quantity. Their husbands and sons, tickled to death and no less proud than the women, translated a 5-time markup, a price per pound, bale, or live weight into Kelvinators, as well as John Deere, into Philco, as well as Body by Fisher. The white porcelain layered over steel, the belts, valves, and bake-like parts gave them deep satisfaction. The humming, throbbing, and softly purring gave the women time. The dirt yards, carefully swept and sprinkled in Haven, became lawns in Ruby, until finally front yards were given over completely to flowers, for no good reason, except there was time in which to do it. The habit, the interest in cultivating plants that could not be eaten, spread, and so did the ground surrendered to it. Exchanging, sharing a cutting here, a root there, a bulb or two, became so frenetic a land grab, husbands complained of neglect and disappointingly small harvests of radishes or the 2 short rows of collards, beets. The women kept on with their vegetable gardens in back, but little by little its produce became like the flowers, driven by desire, not necessity. Iris, phlox, rose, and peonies took up more and more time. Quiet boasting, and so much space, new butterflies journeyed miles to brood in Ruby. Their chrysalises hung in secret under acacias, and from there they joined blues and sulfurs that had been feeding for decades in buckwheat and clover. The red bands drinking from sumac competed with newly arrived creams and whites that loved jewel flowers and nasturtiums. Giant orange wings covered in black lace, covered in pansies and violets. Like the years of garden rivalry, the butterflies were gone that cool October evening, but the consequence remained. Fat, overwrought yards, clumps, and chains of eggs hiding until spring. Touching the pickets lining the path, Dovey climbed the steps. There on the porch, she hesitated and thought of turning back to call on Soane, who had left the meeting early. Soane worried her, seemed to have periods of frailty not related to the death of her sons 5 years ago. Maybe Soane felt what Dovey did, the weight of having 2 husbands, not 1. Dovey paused. then changed her mind and opened the door, or tried to. It was locked again. Something Stuart had recently begun that made her furious, bolting the house as though it were a bank, too. Dovey was sure theirs was the only locked door in Ruby. What was he afraid of? She patted the dish under a pot of Dracaena and picked up the skeleton key. Before that first time, but never again, there was a sign. She had been upstairs, tidying the little foreclosed house, and paused to look through a bedroom window. Down below, the leaf-heavy trees were immobile as a painting. July, dry, 101 degrees. Still, opening the windows would freshen the room that had been empty for a year. It took her a moment, a tap here, a yank or two, but she managed finally to raise the window all the way up and lean forward to see what was left of the garden.